May it please the Court. My name is Jana Yoakum, and I represent Lee Moultrie. And this is an employment discrimination suit alleging racial discrimination, retaliation, and breach of contract against Penn Aluminum. We're appealing a summary judgment determination and a dismissal of his IDHR claim and a statute of limitations issue. Today I'd like to discuss the IDHR issue and also the job performance issues, and I'll defer to my brief for anything that we don't address here. The IDHR claim was dismissed in this case, and the important facts to understand here are that in November of 2009, the report was issued by the IDHR, and they notified Mr. Moultrie that there would be 90 days within which he could file a claim in state court or pursue an administrative process, and the EEOC delayed their determination until March of 2009, and Mr. Moultrie was waiting for his right to sue letter before he filed his claim. He wanted to go to federal court and bring all of his claims in federal court. And the question is, well, can this IDHR claim survive under those circumstances? And there's a time limit for the report from the IDHR of 365 days, and the parties agreed early on to a 300-day extension of time to toll the extension of time or to allow extension of time. That brings into play a tolling provision found in A1 of the applicable statute. And so the tolling provision was already in play under these facts. But even apart from that, there's a question of whether that tolling provision would allow that 90-day provision to be perceived as a statute of limitations that could be equitably tolled, and rather than a jurisdictional time limit. And that's what the cases discuss on these issues. The federal cases discuss whether the time limits involved where a lay person is involved in the process can be perceived as construed as a statute of limitations that can be told. And in this case, the Illinois legislature has evidence and intent that this could be told. And I guess the question that needs to be addressed is language in that provision that says that this applies where the EEOC investigates first. Well, in this case involved the only set of facts which could be construed as having the EEOC investigate first, because basically the EEOC never investigates first. This case involved a concurrent filing with the EEOC and the IDHR, and under the statute there would be a 60-day time period within which the EEOC would have to defer to the state. And also in Illinois, there's a work share provision where the IDHR provides the services on behalf of the EEOC, and then also the IDHR is considered an FEP, which is certified to perform these services and to receive federal funding for performing these services. So this provides the only state of facts which would allow that tolling provision to apply.
I think the tolling provision you're referring to pertains to the amount of time that the state agency has to do its work if there's a charge filed with the EEOC. I don't know that it pertains to the time limit for filing a court action by a complaining party.
I understand your question, but the cases that address these issues don't directly address this particular issue, but they do talk about whether there's evidence in the statute to accommodate the fact that lay people are involved, and in particular the United States Supreme Court in Love v. Pullman has said that these statutes should accommodate the fact that these are lay people bringing their claims. And the cases that address this and that are cited in my brief discuss whether this should be these time limits should be construed as jurisdictional or as allowing equitable tolling. So in this case, it's arguable that equitable tolling is appropriate so that this claim could survive.
Ms. Yoakum, let me just ask a fairly elementary question if I could. Do the state and federal claims here address the same conduct?
Yes.
So is it your position that if we were to affirm the summary judgment on the federal claims, that you'd have a right to continue to litigate the same events in the state court under state law?
No. No. I'm arguing that because he wanted to file all of his cases in federal court and because the EEOC delayed the results of its investigation, that this would be allowed to be brought in the federal court.
And how would that benefit you, adding the state claims into the federal case?
The state claims, even in other states, allow emotional distress damages where the...
So does Title VII.
Title VII? Well, that was my concern, is to make sure that we are allowed to bring in emotional distress damages.
Okay. So if we affirm on the merits of the federal claims, do we need to decide the statute of limitations issue?
That was my assumption, and that's what my argument is today.
But which?
You just informed me that the emotional distress damages are available under Title VII, and I had not seen that was clearly available.
Since the Civil Rights Act Amendments of 1991 took effect. Okay.
I'm a generalist, Your Honor. I'm trying to piece all this
So
stuff.
Are we, but we see a lot of these in particular. So we've been fighting over that statute for the last 22 years.
Well, if I might go on to
I wanted you to get to that because you said that the job performance issues were not true, but your client admitted that there were issues with his job performance and his grievances, and I'm having trouble understanding how you even make out a prima facie case of discrimination in light of his performance issues.
I don't see his grievances as admitting job performance issues, but the evidence shows that each time they filed a grievance, he contested the grievance, and his actual basis for his grievance was never documented. There was an avoidance of the documentation of his actual grievance, and that's what he's complaining about. And for instance, when they alleged that he cut the thermocouple wire, and they ignored testimony in his deposition in the file that said, well, if the thermocouple wire had been cut, the oven would have shut down. So he would have had to replace the thermocouple wire for him to continue to do his job. The idea that these disputed facts are ignored in the motion for summary judgment are demonstrated not only in Mr. Moultrie's affidavit, which basically is just a summary of the evidence, but also in the entire deposition. And they submitted excerpts from the deposition that ignore these facts. But that deposition is available in the union's motion that they incorporated by reference and that I responded to. So in addition to that, where he was instructed to take a product out of the oven, and he says, well, it wasn't annealed yet, and I didn't understand that they wanted me to take it out before it was done, but the product wasn't delayed because I didn't take it out of the oven. The product was delayed because it wasn't annealed yet.
The problem is that none of this has anything to do with race discrimination. This all may be challenges to workplace discipline that is subject to the grievance procedure, but race discrimination was never part of that.
It is part of it because he said this. He told them that when they made these allegations, that these were based on race.
Right. He told the union, but that didn't get included in the union.
He told his employers too, according to his testimony.
I thought there was just one incident where he made a complaint to an employer. Someone, not the union representative who was representing him in the grievance, but to someone on the management side.
Well, it's the testimony that I've quoted in my appellate brief says that he told his immediate supervisor, and he told that supervisor's supervisor.
So, for example, here's an example specifically. February 27th, he files a grievance. He complains that his supervisor temporarily reassigned him and gave his duties to Dave, somebody with less than seniority. He claims there it was racial discrimination and explaining the situation to the union steward, But in the grievance, there was no mention of racial discrimination.
Well, in the grievance that he told the union steward, this is based on race, and the union steward said, you can't bring a racial discrimination case in a grievance. You have to call the business representative. And he did this every time he filed one of those grievances, and they said every time, you can't bring a racial. We don't have, there was no grievance procedure in place for racial discrimination, even though it's specifically provided in the CBA that racial discrimination is a concern. But there was no process in place except that he was supposed to call the business representative, which he did. And the business representative did not bring, there was no procedure beyond telling her and her. There was no, even if they told her and she said, oh, yes, this is race discrimination, there wasn't
like
a process.
That sounds like at least a plausible claim against the union, but you settled with the union, right?
That's right. But the employer was also involved in this in this failure to provide a procedure. There was no procedure in place for him to take a racial discrimination claim even against the management of the company. So the lack of procedure was also implicated the employer. I don't think the dismissal of the union doesn't even implicate the breach of contract claim.
Okay. Well, what we're okay. And
they were involved.
Even if that's right, though, we still then have the problem of finding a basis for inferring there was actual race discrimination in any of this.
Well, that's what I wanted to make sure I nailed down with this job performance issue, because if we say, okay, look at this in terms of the indirect method where we're saying he performed satisfactorily and even that their excuse for firing him, which was based on alleged job performance, was pretext, then sure, that gives us a genuine issue of material fact on those elements. But beyond that, the fact that these are so pervasive and they're inaccurate in a way that can be easily proven or at least put in front of a jury and have the credibility challenged, that is direct evidence, circumstantial evidence in the form of an ambiguous statement that provides part of his mosaic, because really employment discrimination in the workplace is going to take the form of criticism of unreasonable criticism of the job. There, you know, if you're being discriminated against, you're never going to measure up, and it's going to be irrational.
So,
and that's
so
what was happening.
So who's your best
here.
Comparator?
Excuse me?
Who is your best comparator here?
Dave Billups is the best comparator, and they say, well, we fired Dave Billups. Well, they fired him after the employment discrimination was filed. The relevant time here was when Dave Billups replaced him on the fork truck, and Dave Billups didn't do the same job that Lee was criticized for allegedly doing incorrectly. Also,
what about the three non-African American employees who were disqualified from the fork truck position when they had similar issues with their job performance? One for safety violation, one for knocking a building off its foundation, a third for puncturing a pump under the fork truck.
Well, that doesn't fit into the category exactly, but I put it in there because those aren't comparable. Lee dropped a coil. Lee dropped a coil. Everybody drops coils. It's a forklift, and these are round coils and coil. No other employee ever in the history of the company has ever been written up for dropping a coil. Dave Billups dropped five coils and damaged the product and didn't get written up. And Lee is singled out, and that can be proven in the documentary evidence because there are no incident reports involving a dropped coil except for Lee. And besides that, those men that I put in there, those were serious infractions, and they were the only other people demoted from the fork truck. Those serious infractions.
So far, everybody's being treated equally.
Those were not treated equally.
Everybody
Lee was
disciplined.
No, that's not. I'm saying this evidence is unequal treatment because Lee had these minor infractions. Any little thing he did was not only exaggerated, but his write-up was for this minimal infraction that no one else has written up for, and the people who were actually demoted were for very serious, like dishonesty and things like that. And Lee's was like minor mistakes, and not even that. And he's even saying, but these weren't mistakes. The product wasn't even done yet.
All right, you're into your rebuttal. You're actually out of time. I'll give you 1 minute because we did ask you a number of questions. Ms. Lorenz.
Good morning. Susan Lorenz on behalf of the Appellee Penn Aluminum International. Your Honor, I'd like to begin by touching on some of the procedural issues at play that I think might get to the heart of some of the questions you've had and hopefully alleviate the need to delve too deeply. There was a lot of discussion just now about whether or not Mr. Moultrie was meeting the job performance requirements at the time of his demotion. Quite frankly, I would submit that that's not even properly before this court. It was raised by Penn Aluminum in our motion for summary judgment and not responded to at all by Mr. Moultrie in response. Mr. Moultrie, on his own volition, decided to file a joint response to the union's motion and Penn Aluminum's motion, and in doing so, omitted any reference whatsoever to the prima facie elements of a racial discrimination claim. Absent at all from the response was any discussion whatsoever about his job performance at the time of his demotion. Assuming arguendo, though, that this court finds that those issues have not been waived by Mr. Moultrie and are properly before this court on appeal, I would submit, as Judge Williams and Judge Sykes already pointed out, he admits that there were performance issues, and going as far back as within days of being bumped into his fork truck position. Mr. Moultrie was bumped in September of 2008. He had previously held the position, so pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement, he should have had 2 days by which to bring himself back up to speed on the way to perform that job. We gave him more than that time, but within 6 days, he was already receiving counseling for poor performance on that position. 2 days later, he received a written warning for that on a separate incident. Days after that, he received a second counseling session. A month.
Were these all dropped coils?
No. Unfortunately, these were a various array of different performance issues, a fact that Mr. Moultrie ignores. These were issues involving leaving objects in the oven too long, which resulted in a missed delivery to a customer. There were the cutting of the thermocouple wires. There were numerous incidents that all resulted in a meeting with his two immediate supervisors in October, and the issues continued after that. Mr. Moultrie ultimately filed his first grievance not until February of 2009 after receiving about five written and oral warnings. At that point in time, he engaged in further issues and ultimately was disqualified in April of 2009. So at no point in time from within days of receiving the fork truck position to the time of his disqualification was Mr. Moultrie ever meeting the job performance requirements of the position.
He's still working for Penn?
He retired on his own volition in 2013. As for the comparators that that opposing counsel raised, as this court pointed out, Dave Billups arguably is not or was not similarly situated to Mr. Moultrie. As opposing counsel pointed out, he was not holding the same position, and therefore, under the rules provided for determining whether or not someone is similarly situated, they need to be subject to the same supervisor, holding the same or similar position, and have engaged in the same or similar type of infractions. Mr. Billups did not meet any of those qualifications, but even assuming that this court finds that he was terminated by Penn Aluminum. He fell asleep on the job, an infraction that Mr. Moultrie, in his deposition, admitting to also committing, which raises a whole other set of issues, but was not terminated for. Mr. Billups was terminated. There is no separate treatment there. As for the three comparators that we raised that were non-African Americans, as Judge Williams pointed out, they were also disqualified and in some instances terminated. There was no dissimilar treatment between Mr. Moultrie and our other employees. Real quickly on the retaliation claim, which I believe opposing counsel was touching on but not delving into, that is also subject to waiver by opposing counsel. It was not responded to whatsoever in our lower court briefings. Penn Aluminum raised it in its motion for summary judgment. Opposing counsel opted not to respond to it, and therefore it is our position that it has been waived and is not properly before this court on appeal. As for count four, the Illinois Department of Human Rights claim that was subject to a motion to dismiss for untimeliness, as Judge Sykes pointed out, this concept of the tolling provision is wholly inapplicable here because the tolling that is referenced applies to the IDHR's ability to investigate a claim within a certain period of time and not with the employee's ability to file suit upon receipt of the notice of right to sue letter.
Is it your contention, counsel, that the way federal and state law interact here means that the plaintiff has to bring the state and federal claims at different times in different lawsuits?
If that's the only way that they could preserve their claim, and I believe that that was expressly suggested by Judge Posner in Herman v. CenCom Cable, that if the only way to preserve the appeal, the lawsuit, is to file separate claims, meaning the Illinois Department of Human Rights Act claim in the circuit court while the EEOC conducts its investigation on the federal claim, then yes, that would be something that understood assumably would
be. We've been dealing with these kinds of complications for a number of years. I think it was earlier this year that Dukerin dealt with that problem. And it looks like the Illinois Supreme Court has tried to straighten this out some. But I'm trying to figure out how we can avoid creating unnecessary complication. I would think that if the claims are simply mirror images of each other, there's really no point in pursuing them separately.
One would agree with that, and one would wonder then why it's filed in the federal suit at all, except for the fact that there are caps on the amount of damages attainable under Title VII, and those same caps are not at play under the Illinois statute. But be that as it may.
Would you agree? Go ahead. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
No, I apologize, Judge.
No, I
would just say that in the event that it appeared that the timing would not work out to Mr. Moultrie's benefit had he opted to wait for the EEOC's right to sue letter, as he did in this case, then, yes, he could have either filed a state court claim to preserve his right to do so and then added it into his federal court claim, or he could have brought the breach of contract action against the union and the employer and joined then under supplemental jurisdiction his IDHR claim. He didn't do that either.
Would you agree that as between the Title VII claim and the Illinois human rights claims, as to merits at least, res judicata would apply in either direction?
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Correct. With respect to count one, which it appears opposing counsel would like to rest on her briefings, I would like to point out that at no point in time, either in the lower court or in this court, did they respond to the fact that the breach of contract claim is expressly preempted by Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act. So while Mr. Moultrie spends a lot of time responding to the question of tolling of the Del Costello six-month time period and whether or not Penn Aluminum fraudulently concealed steps to take, all of those questions are subject to the fact that the claim itself is preempted by Section 301's requirement that the employee take advantage of all of the administrative opportunities in the collective bargaining agreement before it file any sort of lawsuit.
So
he should have had to have gone through the arbitration procedure, which he did not do.
Okay, I thought the union decided not to pursue it.
He had the right within 10 days of receiving Penn Aluminum's Step 3 letter to request arbitration, and he did
not. On his own?
On his own, yes. If the court has no other questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Lawrence. 1 minute, Ms. Yocum.
Okay. The preemption issue was not addressed by the district court, and I assume they agreed with us and ruled based on other issues, and she didn't raise it in her brief. But I did address the case that discussed the preemption issue, and I think I addressed it sufficiently to bring our side into light. The res judicata issue, if the Illinois dismissal was res judicata, then that would have meant that the merits were decided in a way that arguably bound the federal court, and I don't think that's what could have happened here. And I'm particularly interested in the damages cap There's no damages cap under the Illinois statute, and that would be very helpful to our case. Job performance as well as the retaliation were clearly set forth. The fact issues were raised in our brief below on our response to summary judgment. And we didn't admit, we were not admitting performance issues. We were saying he was criticized for his performance. That doesn't mean that he admitted that he did something wrong, that the criticism was there. I believe I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under advisement.